is just so intimate. It's like, I mean, this is, you're holding hands with the rhino.
To touch on like my disability is something that I haven't always shown. And especially like a picture, wow, like my hand, like that's my hand. It doesn't look like everyone else's. So that picture is the most unique picture possible.
That moment of near disaster.
And with difficulty kept my course.
It was for us the pleasure of discovering.
Liv Stone, 3-time world champion. Oh my God. Surfer extraordinaire, conservationist. How was the surf this morning? Was it good?
Yeah, it was kind of good. There were a ton of people out there, and they're like all guys, and I was like, ah! I was the only girl out there, but it's okay. I got some good ones and then came in.
What, like in terms of your surfing style, you're mostly shortboard, right? I've seen some pictures of,
yeah.
See, I got a picture of your surfing here. Oh my God.
Oh yes.
Look at that.
That was just from the other day. That was like one of the best waves I've ever gotten at the Oceanside Pier. And my friend was in the water filming, and it was just like perfect. You know, like when the perfect moment lines up, then the perfect shot is just like magic. But yeah, I usually shortboard.
I've tried a lot of surf filming, and that moment is very elusive, right?
It's like, it's half a second and you got to get it perfect. Yeah, it was like magical. I got out of the water and I was like, did you get it? And he was like, yeah, and it, yeah, it was perfect. It was super cool because he was in the water, and water shots are really difficult.
Yeah. Everything's moving.
Because you have like the water housing and everything. Yeah, so I was like super stoked that he got
that. The camera's moving, the wave's moving, the location of where it's going to peak is moving, and then you've got to like just be there at the right time. And then on top of that, you got all the other surfers that are trying to go for the same wave. So
yeah. Exactly.
You know, it's like this one image must have taken weeks to try to get, or was it, how long have you been?
Actually, like the day before that, I paddled out and I was like, hey, Chris, his name's Chris Grant. I said, hey, do you want to come out and film? I would like love to get some water shots. Haven't gotten water shots in a while. And so the day before that, it was kind of meh. Like I didn't get a lot of really great waves because you can never really control the conditions out there and also the people and just the waves and everything. So I didn't get really many great waves like that wave. And I was like, hey, that wasn't like the best session I've ever had. Do you want to come out the next day? And then that's when we got it. So honestly, it only took 2 surf sessions. So I was like super stoked. And I was so lucky because when that wave came through and I got that really good turn and landed it, I felt really great. And then the ocean just kind of went flat. And there was like nothing else for like 30 minutes. So I feel like it was so meant to be that that wave rolled through because I was like really hoping for a good shot and it worked out.
What is it about surfing that you love? I mean, I'm a surfer. I know for me that it's almost hard to explain, but not really. I mean, there's a lot to love about it. But for you, I know you started surfing at the age of what, 14? And went on to be a pioneer and a leader in the world of adaptive surfing and just surfing in general. So what is it that drives you?
For me, I think it's more than just the sport and just the competitiveness of it. You know, I've loved my experiences competing and stuff, but for me, it's more of my everyday lifestyle. And it's a kind of a getaway for me and an outlet where I can just go out into the water, forget about like the stresses of school or whatever I have going on. And I can just like disconnect. And I also feel like really close to nature. You're out there in the water and you're pretty much at the mercy of the ocean. And that's very, very humbling. So a lot of times I just go out there. And then when I come back to the beach, I'm like refreshed, cleansed, and like ready to conquer the day pretty much. So it always like just kind of is a mental reset for me. It's like, it's definitely very spiritual, I would say. I don't just treat it as, oh, I have to go out and train the hardest and do the best. And yeah, I want to surf well. But for me, it's like finding that mental headspace.
I can totally relate, you know, and metaphorically and also literally it's stepping into the storm, right? It's in a way, because the waves are these energies that are created by storms and brought to us from afar. Right. I started surfing like more seriously a couple of years, maybe 5 years ago or so, and went into bigger and bigger waves. And one of the things that has always been the most challenging for me has been just staying calm when you're in a big one and you, there's three or four waves coming at you and you know you're about to get like really taken down and held down for a while.
Right.
How is that for you? Yeah. Do you have, I see in this image that you've got like kind of paddles on your hands, right, to create a bit more leverage. How is it?
Yeah, I call them aquatic prosthetics. That's like the official term, but they do look like paddles and they just go on my hands like right here. There's two straps that just strap on and they're pretty much the circumference of someone's just kind of regular, quote, normal hand. So that gives me paddle power and I'm able to paddle out past the waves. But I do prefer breaks that have a channel and I'm able to get out a little easier because getting out and piling into the waves are definitely one of the hardest things for me. Like when I'm up surfing, it's like, you know, I feel like I do really well, but what I struggle with a lot is the paddling out and those paddles really, really help me. But when it does get big, to be honest, I'm not going to like, you know, fudge it and say like, oh yeah, I love going out on big days. Cause I went out yesterday and it was kind of big and I got out there. I don't know how I got out there, first of all. And I see like these big waves coming through and I somehow, you know, when you scratch over the surface of the set and you're like, whew, and then there's like two more big ones out there. And I was like, ah. I try not to
did
go.
Did it take you on the head?
It took me under a bit. And I just was like, you know what? I don't feel comfortable. And I went in because I don't know. I know my limit. And I think that's really important. I wasn't going to be out there and be like, yeah, I can surf these big waves. No, like I went in and I was like, yeah, no shame. I'm going to go in. It was too scary for me. Cause I don't like being held down like that for sure.
Yeah. For me, when I get taken down, the first thing I grab is my leg because I have my leash attached to my leg. And that way, if it gets ripped off the prosthetic, then at least I didn't lose my leg. It'll float back to the surface or back to the shore on the board. But by holding on to it, I got something to climb up, you know, out of the darkness when you're taking them. For people that might be listening, what we're talking about is that when the big waves come, they don't come as one, they come as three or four usually. And, you know, right. And when you get over that first one, it's great. But then you see two more mountains coming at you that are bigger and bigger. And it's like,
right.
And then you're taken down. And for what could feel like 3 minutes or 4 minutes is really just 20 seconds. And then for you, do you have any kind of mental, like, what do you do? Cause for me, I try to just meditate on my kids. I'm like, I get really calm and I just think about them tossing me around in the hot tub. And that's how I try to keep my heart rate down. What do you do to keep your heart rate regulated in those moments?
I focus on my breath. When I was out there, it's so crazy that we're talking about this because just yesterday I experienced it. I'm like, Liv, I kind of just talk myself off the cliff, basically. Liv, you're okay. I speak to myself and I try and stop my heart from racing and I focus on my breath and I time it. Like my timing is big because I don't duck dive. So I ditch my board, make sure there's no one behind me, and then swim as far as I can down. And I just think to myself, get down as far as you can because then you'll almost be safe. So my safe zone is just swimming as far as I can to the bottom. And but when it really works me, if I don't go deep enough and then the wave pulls me so much and I, you know, that feeling where like you think you're at the top, but you're not. So you like take a breath and you're like, wait, I'm not at the top yet. So just working myself step by step, talking to myself through it, like you're okay. And usually that is helpful because panic is like the last thing you want to do.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Right. But it's just so I'm feeling really, like I empathize with that feeling of having to think slightly differently about those takedowns because, you know, it is scary if, for example, I had a big wave that ripped my leg off and the board was gone for me and I no longer had a rope to climb up. And then I feel like, okay, I'm tossed around in this ocean and I don't have a kick. You know, I don't have like the leg kick. I've got my arms. and you, but you're kind of the same thing just with the arms versus the legs, right? So do you, like, what do you do to, why do we keep stepping into that danger zone? Like, I don't know why I keep doing it, but I love it. I just kind of love it. But what do you think it is? I can't explain it. Why, you know, my kids are like, why do you keep on doing that? But
I know, why do we put ourselves in that kind of dangerous position? And I have actually never really thought of it like that. I don't know why I keep going out. I think it's just, like I said, like our love for the ocean, we want to be out there. And it is a humbling experience. Like, even having those scary experiences, you learn so much about yourself. I feel like I grow as a person, grow as a surfer, and learn how to do better next time. So if I go out to the, like yesterday, I really didn't do well at this one spot, but I learned a lot. Like, hey, maybe I should paddle out somewhere else. Or maybe I should bring like a bigger board to have more paddle power to get out faster. So it's like, it's always, I feel like for us, especially with people with disabilities, just adapting and figuring out like, okay, what can I do next time? Yeah. Because we want to go out, we want to experience that natural high and catching waves and be able to like shred just as much as everyone else. So I think we keep putting ourselves in difficult positions to become stronger people.
And because we want to experience that flow state, right? I mean, who doesn't? It's a human joy. Have you ever been in a barrel? I saw a picture of you online inside. It looked like maybe was that Texas or where was that? The wave pool. Was it the wave pool?
That was, that was Kelly Slater's wave pool.
In Lemoore?
Yes. Have you ever been there?
Ranch. Oh, yeah.
It's like the best place in the whole world, I'm convinced. Like, you're in the middle of like the desert and like you're like, there's no waves here. It's kind of like a random little town. And then like these gates open, it's like Jurassic Park, and you pull in and there's just like this perfect left or right coming through. And I'm like, so I went for like the day one time, and that was my first ever barrel was at the Surf Ranch.
Yeah, me too. Oh, I haven't gotten a real one yet. I mean, I've gotten into a real one, but I haven't made it out of a real one. Nature's barrel. But my first fully in and then out of a barrel was same place, the Magic.
That's actually the same with me. I have pulled into barrels in the ocean, in Oceanside, Northside. I pulled in and like I saw the vision, but then just got like absolutely smoked and didn't make it out. But yeah, that's so crazy. We both got, and you made it out of the barrel at the wave pool.
Yeah, I made it out of, after many, many attempts. I mean, it's the perfect wave, right? But like you said, a moment like that is magical. It is incredible. What they built there is a phenomenal place and is one of the funnest places I've ever been in my life. I think of everybody that I was with there, we all said it was one of the best days of our life. But this is nature, and nature is unpredictable. You can never predict where that moment of the wave is going to be. So it's just infinitely harder to line up out in the real world.
Yeah, but I agree. Like when I know, like the feeling of being inside a barrel, like even if you don't make it out, it feels like the world stops. And like for me, it's that sound. You know, like when you're surfing, you hear a lot of sloshing of the waves and it's loud and you can hear the seagulls. And then when the wave goes over, it's just silent. And you can hear the water right next to your ear and you can feel like the power of it. Unless you're going backside, it would be this way. But it's unmatched. The feeling that's why surfers keep going out in big, heavy conditions.
Yeah. Wow. You couldn't have said it better. You know, it's like, we're chasing some kind of existential feeling, right? I've heard people say that time stops. Everybody says, you know, different things. I've heard people say that they hear the or it's completely silent. I've heard people say that they feel like they're on some super intense drug, you know, or something. But it's just, it's yeah. Like, my reason for becoming obsessed with the barrel didn't start off with ever thinking that I could ride it. It was I talk about this story a lot, but it is, I think it's relevant to this, is that I saw a picture of Mike Coots. Do you know, I'm sure you know Mike, you guys are buddies.
Yes. And, oh, I love that
you
shot.
Know, and the reason why it's framed is because the moment I saw it, I was sitting in a hospital bed getting my leg cut off, and I had no idea what it would be like I had no idea if I'd be able to walk normally or do anything that I used to do. And all of a sudden I see this picture of somebody inside that chandelier room, and it made me rethink from the outside what I could do. But then I think about a person like, that's a perspective where he gave me this, like this image of where the crystal ceiling is. And I'm sure you've had this experience where people will come up to you and say, you made me rethink what was possible for me. But then I talked to Mike recently on a different podcast. And I think if I had to ask again, it was like, when he started out, nobody was really doing it. You know, there wasn't a lot of amputees surfing. He was told he shouldn't surf. He was told that it would destroy his leg. And there was all these outside perceptions that were being placed on him that he had to break through and choose to create another narrative. Did you have a similar experience? I mean, because I don't know, it must be that there's a lot of, from when you were 14 till now, there's been a big journey. But before that first day of surfing, there must have been a lot of outside projections of safety concerns and other things like that. Like,
yeah.
How'd you grapple with that?
Yeah, when I was first learning, there was a lot of uncertainty on like how to adapt. Like in the beginning, I wasn't even using the paddles that we were chatting about because I just didn't know. Like it was a step-by-step process. And I think when I first started, I had a lot of outside noise. Like, I think that's what you're getting at. Like a lot of people telling you, no, you shouldn't do it this way. You need to do it this way, or you can't even be in the water. And I've had a lot of outside noise and it comes from a good place. People do just want to help. You should be able to just pop up right to your feet. You have to get to your feet right away. There's no native feet. There's no this, like you have to do that. You have to get to your feet. And I'm like, well, okay, like then I'm not ever going to be able to surf. Like I can't, like I physically can't. I don't like saying that word, but I really cannot do that. And so I just kind of had to put a lot of those noises away. Oh, you should be riding a longboard. You have such good style. Or you should, you know, a lot of people just are, they think, I guess, what's best, I guess. But I think you really just have to like Mike Coutts was like, well, no, I'm going to go out and surf and I'm going to do it my way and I'm going to shred. And I think everyone has their, I like saying this a lot. I come back to it. It's like everyone has their own unique style. Like I surf with from my knees to my feet. I have paddles. Like I have to adapt certain ways. And that's just how I surf. Like I've had a lot of outside noise, people telling me to surf differently. But once I feel like I shut that out a couple of years ago, I grew as a person and grew as a surfer. And I feel like my surfing took off without trying to nitpick each and everything like that I was doing. Mm. If that makes sense.
It makes a ton of sense. Is when you clear out the noise of basically external perceptions, and then you find the frontier that you've got for yourself. Yeah.
Right.
You know, the other thing that was interesting that Mike said that I listened to was he at first was kind of like his injury was a shark attack, as everybody that might have listened to the previous podcast right. knows. I heard in one interview of his that it was hard for him at first to want to wear shorts. I mean, he lives in Hawaii. That's going to suck, right? And then it wasn't until he started really coming to, you know, I mean, both with surfing and other things like showing and sharing his story on social media and elsewhere that he started to really realize that, hey, I don't need to hide this. For me, I remember the first time I stared in the mirror after my leg was removed and I'm like, wait, I look different than I did for the last, you know, X number of years. I was like, well, what, like, who am I now? And looking right. in the mirror, I remember also having those moments where it was like, well, what are people going to think of me? And, you know, I just want to know what I've heard you say this before where it was like surfing might have been a big critical thing for you as well in that journey of self-perception. And at the age of 14, that's like one of the hardest ages anyway, right? Like, what was that like? I mean, you know, growing up with the weight of outside perception and then having to break through that.
Yeah. Well, I think when I was younger, you know, I grew up with this disability, so I just kind of adapted along the way. And I don't feel like I didn't learn new things like you would have learned to walk again. I kind of just was blessed in that way to where I didn't know differently. So I can I can't understand what you went through, but I can understand that I came from being very self-conscious about my disability to being confident in who I am. So around that time, like 13, 14, like, you know, everyone goes through changes. It's middle school, high school. And I had a lot of self-doubt about how I looked because I was a girl and I wanted to fit in and I wanted to be cool. And, you know, and I found out, like, it's crazy. Like, I've always had a disability, but it kind of hit me in those like early teens. I am different than everyone else. Like, I kind of would like look around me in school and be like, I start to notice, wow, I'm way different than everyone else. And I think it just took years of my parents being supportive, going into surfing, finding myself, finding my true passions and outlets. Like, confidence doesn't just come from an overnight thing. Oh, well, I'm not different than anyone else. It's not like confidence just doesn't like hit you. It's like grown over time. And yeah, it's just been like an ongoing process of learning to love myself. And it's still an ongoing process. I still have days where like I find kids staring at me and I'm like, I really didn't need that today. Like, can I just be like going to a grocery store and not have someone say something to me? So some days I get a little like, oh, but then I have to realize like I am blessed and lucky to have these opportunities that I do to be alive, to be healthy, to be mentally and physically fit. And I just think of like those positives and it keeps me going.
Yeah. And the community, right? You mentioned your family. You sent me that image. Who's that? Is that yeah. Mom?
Yeah, that's my mom. Oh. Yeah. My mom comes with me like every day when I go surf. So she films and I surf. And so she captures a lot of my waves.
What a mom.
And then we go. Yeah, she's the best. She's been like my number one supporter since day one.
Wow. Yeah. For me, it was my son and my daughter. They're like, there's no excuses, Dad. Let's go. Let's climb the mountain. You know, I can't thank them enough. Yeah. But I've been thinking a lot about the role of perception from just a scientific standpoint, yeah, like a neuroscience kind of thing. Right. And it's like, you know, perception is so powerful because we create our realities around it, right? I was coaching softball. I'd never played team sports. I don't know how to play softball. I don't know how to play baseball. I didn't know what I was doing, right, at all. But the coach, the head coach, like the super coach, was like, "It's okay, buddy, you got it." And he sent me this video because it was for my daughter's team, and she didn't know what she was doing either. None of us knew what we were doing. And he sent me this video about this thing called the Pygmalion effect. And he's like, "All my coaches have to watch this first." And it was just about how, you know, if you go and you've got a team of 10 people and you're always favoring one person because you've got, as a coach, a greater expectation out of that person to succeed, then that person will succeed more because of the fact that, not because they're more talented, but because they have this different expectation in their head of what is possible for them that's constantly being reinforced. Versus if you got another person who you're like, Johnny's okay at baseball, but he's not going to be a pro. So let's just make sure that we keep him involved. But, sorry, Johnny. Johnny's in the other room. Johnny, you're probably really good at baseball. the role of that negative or lack of expectation of success actually has this huge impact on that person's ability to show up the way they want to show up. They give up easier, and slowly over time, with each one of those reinforced narratives, they slip away and then they give up and they don't ever reach their full potential. And I just think that one of the things that I see in your story, and I'm not trying to project onto your story or anything, but I just want to know what you thought about this, is that you said you grew up and you had to realize that at some point you are different and to accept that, right? And the outside perception of are you going to be able to swim in big waves? Must have been this thing which you had to like literally rewrite in your own mind and say, you know what? I'm not going to not do what I love because I'm going to keep trying. You had to right. break through that lack, that sort of out external doubt. So what is it about your brain? Does that apply to other parts of your life? Do you like, is every part of your life this world championship? It must be, right? Are you a gold medalist in everything?
No, definitely not. I have like my flaws for sure, but I believe like mindset is everything. And you can truly push through like anything in life, like through whether it's like a surfing competition or like pushing through big waves. Like I kind of have that mental headspace when I'm working in school or I'm out in the wilderness and I come to an obstacle, I just kind of like slow down and I like talk myself through it. I know that sounds kind of strange, but like when you let your mind go like out and just go into panic mode and just like start self-doubting and become anxious. I mean, yeah, everyone has their days, but I try and just like look around me and see that, wow, this world is so beautiful. I'm out here in this beautiful ocean. I'm blessed to be alive and healthy. And I just kind of, I'm not always positive. Like there are days like when I'm not for sure. But just try and walk myself through it. That's the biggest thing. And I think also comparison is like the killer of love. I've heard that quote before and I really like it because if I look at someone surfing or I look at someone's degree or someone's accomplishments, I'm like, oh, I wish I would be like that. Or like you said, like that baseball player that maybe wasn't as good as Billy.
Yeah, Johnny's not so good. Billy's much better. Yep.
But if he would like keep looking up at Billy thinking, oh, I wish I'd be like him, wish I'd be like him. And I think social media does that a lot where you like look at a perfect influencer or quote perfect person, you end up honestly feeling like crap about yourself. And like, so I think just harnessing like who you truly are in your core and living that out through your whole life and just trying to be positive, trying to do the things that you're passionate about rather than trying to be someone that you're not and trying to change, like I said, my style of surfing. Like my style is my style and my life is my life. Like I love wildlife conservation and all of that other stuff. I'm not trying to be like the perfect quote Instagram model or trying to be like someone else, because I think comparing yourselves to others, you're really not going to get anywhere.
You mentioned wildlife conservation. I got another image ready. This one's cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a day we did three rhino that day where the conservation team would dart the rhino and then they would, I mean, that guy is awake, but he's basically paralyzed. So they tranquilize him and then they take like samples of blood and all the different types of things they need to track it. And then that dude had a 86 centimeter horn. It was the biggest horn on the reserve. And it was super cool to be next to like a beast like that, but so beautiful at the same time. And I feel like we were talking about that mental headspace that I feel in the water and the way I feel out in the African bush and surrounded by wildlife and like at the mercy of the elements is how very similar to how I feel in the water.
Yeah. I mean, being, there's a temple of nature, right? Like that's just, something that I think every surfer or anybody who's ever spent any time in a beautiful place in nature can agree to. I was just talking to this folklore specialist in a previous episode of this podcast, and he studies all the ancient stories of, in his particular case, he's mostly looked at the Norse god stories and things like that, and all the Viking stories, but also Native American stories and elsewhere. And I was like, what is the one takeaway of all the ancient stories? Like, what are they all trying to tell us? And he was basically saying that they all spent a lot more time in nature, you know? I mean, not by like, oh, I'm going to go meditate in nature, but just, we used to exist in nature a lot more. You know, we used to exist outside of the boundaries of our walls and our light switches. And because of that, I think our human experience was much more humbled or maybe more grateful or, you know, believed in something bigger. But then, you know, when you see an image like this is so, it's beautiful, right? It's Is this your hand and the rhino's foot side by side?
Yeah, so that was earlier that day. That's my hand with the, it's actually, matter of fact, a baby rhino. So that's pretty big. Like that female baby rhino wasn't even fully grown yet. And to be, yeah, next to them was just pretty amazing. And like giving back and helping them, because yes, like it looks like in that picture that they look like, everyone like sees that picture and they say, oh, like, is the rhino okay? Like they're on the ground. Like, what did you do to it? It almost looks like we like hunted it. I'm like, no, we're trying to help it. It's for conservation purposes. And it's like trying to educate my audience on like how we've needed to step in and take action for these animals, or they are going to become extinct.
Yeah.
And I love that about conservation, because it's about stepping in and helping a greater cause than ourselves.
This, what is this? Is this like a morning or an evening? Because I can see the sun's kind of low on the horizon, maybe.
Yeah, that was like later afternoon.
Later afternoon in a park called, what was the name of the park? The conservation park?
Maritaba.
Maritaba in Limpopo, Maritaba. South Africa.
Yeah.
And you've darted this rhino to take blood samples to monitor health and make sure that everything's okay.
Yep.
Tell me about the moment what was like the moment that led up to this? What's the story behind this? Because I could tell that you were out in the field for a while. And
it's such a gnarly process. Like, so the vet comes in a helicopter because, you know, rhino, you can't just like walk up to them and like dart them. That's not safe. So they are in a helicopter. I've never been up there. That's super cool. And they shoot, they have a dart gun, and then they shoot the rhino from above. I mean, they have to get like the perfect shot, like right basically in the rump. And then it takes a while for the medicine to kick in. And then we're on like walkie talkies and radios saying, okay, like the rhino fell on this tree or whatever. So when the rhino's fully down and fully sedated, then the team comes in and they put the collar on the rhino to track their movements.
Mm.
Because obviously poaching is a big issue. So that collar pings off of a tower in the park and they get like a live location. And that's really important for their health, because obviously if, God forbid, there was a poaching incident, we would be able to get there and try and save the animal as fast as we could, or just manage the situation and manage the population and just protect them as much as we can. And for my first ever rhino intervention, it was very emotional for me, because the medicine can make the rhino convulse, and like the legs and like the head, and like they don't have control of their body. So they look like they're in like a lot of pain, and which like my colleagues assured me they weren't, but I was just kind of standing there like, oh my gosh, they are put in this situation because of what humanity has like pushed them into, these tiny little regions, and their populations have dwindled so much to where we have to manage them so closely. We have to have eyes on like all of the rhino in the park. I'm like, what has the world come to that we have to do this to them? And so it was a very like emotional experience for me. I didn't even like know how to react. I'm like mad that these guys are, and these beautiful creatures are endangered, but I know that we have to step in and do something, or they'll be extinct forever. So it's like, it's a field that just brings me so much hope that like we can restore endangered species. And it was a very impactful moment.
And then you took this picture, which you sent me, and I just, you know, it's a very deliberate picture, right? It's very specific. It's your hand and the rhino's hoof, touching, holding each other. And what's the symbolism behind this? What is going through, like, in you, when you, because I've seen this image as well with you in a, I think you had a similar image with the paw of a big cat, your hand next to the paw of a big cat. What are you trying to say through this art?
I think it's like me trying to connect to nature on a level that I never knew was possible. And that, like, you show people that, yes, humans may be, like, the smartest of the animals in the animal kingdom, but, like, we deserve to rewrite what we did wrong, and help save them and give them the opportunity that they wouldn't have because animals can't speak for themselves. And so I was kind of down on her level. That was a baby calf down on her level. Like, I'm here for you. I see you and you'll be okay. And, yeah, that was impactful for me.
Yeah. It's a very like cross species moment of connection. Right. And it also feels like it's a statement of shared vulnerability, in a way, right? It's like, because it's just so intimate. It's like, I mean, this is, you're holding hands with the rhino.
It is like, also to touch on like my disability is something that I haven't always shown. And especially like a picture, wow, like my hand, like that's my hand. It doesn't look like everyone else's. So that picture is the most unique picture possible because no one out there is like me, and no one out there is like that baby calf either. And it's like this beautiful expression of life.
Yeah, powerful. It's of our, what makes us beautiful is our differences, right? Our different experiences, our different perspectives. God, you're making me cry now. I'm like, oh, I gotta take a photo with my stump. It shows, because when I have my prosthetic on, it's like, okay, I look kind of robotic and cool. But when I take my prosthetic off, I'm very vulnerable, you know, and I'm hopping around, and it's like, okay, this is my raw naked body. And it's different. It's a different, and I think you talking about that really, no, you really touched something. I appreciate that. So now you've gone on, you're a world champion surfer, which, by the way, I hope we can surf together sometime. We live so close to each other. Let's go surfing.
Yeah, definitely.
You gotta do that.
I know. We definitely should go out and catch some waves.
Yeah. I've got a secret key to Blacks. So if you ever want to go to that and surf the right point, then,
I heard that sounds amazing. I love that.
Let's go. But the other question is, you know, you moved on to conservation, or not moved on, you've taken on conservation, and is there a merger of the two? Like, you know, like, will you be able to, cause Mike's working a lot with shark conservation, you know, in the oceans, and, are you going to start working in the oceans? What's your main focus now?
Focus, believe it or not, is building my degree. I'm still working in schools getting my environmental science degree, so like once that chapter is closed, then like I can kind of figure out like what to do now that I have my degree. Do I go full-blown into conservation in Africa, or do I kind of have like trying and have this mix of surfing and Africa and whatnot, because my heart really is in two places, the ocean and the bush. Not quite sure how that's going to merge. It's like that big question.
Well, you grew up landlocked, that a lot of people, right? Ask, I mean, you me. Grew up in New Hampshire, right? Somewhere? So you grew up in the middle of a non-ocean place, and then you moved to the ocean. So you're a person of many, of right. many places.
Yeah, I my heart belongs in a lot of different areas, and I think that's a beautiful thing. But it's just managing my relationships, friendships, family connections along the way, and building my life with a lot of different things that makes me happy, whether that's surfing for like a month and then bush in the month, like I don't know what it brings, but probably not something in like marine biology. I definitely really love more of land animals. Mm. But I don't know, like I really feel like I could go anywhere with my degree and explore and travel. I don't know. Like
I got to connect you with,
I'm so open.
Dr. Braun, who's the head of the conservation program at the San Diego Zoo and Wildlife, refuge, here. They go out all over the world on these conservation expeditions. And you know, it, maybe you never know. You might be a jungle person. You know, you thought it was the plains. Maybe you're a jungle
like,
person.
I don't know. I would love to just explore all different parts of the world and like all different types of wildlife and ecosystems and try and help as much as I can.
Yeah, so that's the key. Okay, so you are always there thinking about how to help these, as you said, animals that don't have voices for themselves. And that, like, that deep empathy and desire to care for others, where did that come from? Does it originate with a paying it forward of this image, or is it what's happening here, or is it like what inside you inspired you to choose to be thinking so altruistically with your energy and your effort, as a life passion, when really a lot of people who are facing challenges often think of what they need to do to make their situation better. What turned you outwards?
Right. Gosh, that's so good. I don't know if I've actually really thought of it. I don't know. I just feel like I have so much to give back. And I want to focus on a life of like making a change rather than like building up myself. And I think I've always really loved like nature and animals. And so that's always been like very deep rooted in me. And I feel like I just kind of had to like, that needed to be like pulled out a bit. And so when I visited South Africa, and I was experiencing the bush and was experiencing also surfing, because I surfed in South Africa, I was like, you feel so humbled in the bush. And I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the animals, and I fell in love with the lifestyle of being out there in the harsh elements and being able to survive and protect these animals. And not enough, I think what really turned me is not enough people know about it. And there's a lot of people living a life that like is affecting those animals and destroying like the surrounding ecosystem. So I just want to protect as much as I can and give back as much as I can, really. But I don't know if there was like a moment that just like really turned me. I've always like loved animals, but I just kind of found like in your 20s, in your early 20s, you kind of try and figure out like what you want to do with your life and like what is your passions, what is your purpose. And so on that South Africa trip, I was really just introduced to, wow, I could really make a change in something that's not just focusing on myself.
Mm. You know, not everybody gets to that place. I think somehow I have a hunch that it's connected to the same thing inside you that drove you to win 3 world, gold medals, and everything else, is to be the champion of the situations rather than, to let those situations dictate what happens. I mean, with the specific cases of rhinos, it's pretty tough, right? Like it's a whole market of people that want to somehow use the horns as medicines, and it's ridiculous. And the poaching that, a lot driven by black markets in China and elsewhere. And it's a cultural shift that has to change, right? So do you think you will ever end up doing like big speaking tours to try to change the understanding of people and these animals, or like how do we stop the demand on this particular species in order to try to stop the problem from where its source is?
It's like a whole cultural thing, like you said. Like it would be changing the mindset of an entire group of people that like think that killing rhino is okay. And like that's hard to turn around, because for centuries we've just been like killing off very precious parts of the ecosystem and keystone species. So yeah, like I would love to like speak more about it, different conferences or whatnot, and just get, like I said, give rhinos or whatever type of endangered species a voice that they can't have, and be able to defend them as much as possible. But I think it's also like posting on social media, like awareness, like social media has more power than anyone really realizes. Because someone may see that post of the rhino and be like, wow, I didn't even know that was going on. And then maybe go and sign a petition to help, because of all those online petitions, like to help block some type of black market trade. Like there's all these like different like loopholes that you could do. So yeah, like hands-on field work for sure. And also bringing awareness through social media.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that our platform is looking different than other people helps? I know for me, right, like for example, when I do a lot of TV work with National Geographic and elsewhere, and I do public speaking, and part of it is like, you know, there's got to be something where it's just like, okay, I just look different, right? I just look different. And so there's something that the brain says, okay, well, that's not what I'm used to. Let me just like try to be a little bit more open-minded. That happens to me all the time. Like if I got arrested in the middle of a coup in Sudan, and my team, we were all like, you know, freaked out. And then I just pulled my leg pants up and I took my leg off, and it shifted the conversation entirely because the arresting officers were like, huh, what? Like it just put them on their back foot a little bit. Do you think that you would use your visual differences to try to put people on their back foot and make them rethink conservation in a different way? I mean, I know it sounds like a weird connection, but it...
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. I really haven't thought of that. I kind of build a platform of people that would say, quote, find me inspiring. I don't know if you like that word, but a lot of people use it for people with disabilities. And so like they follow me because of a lot of different things I do. And I don't feel like it's just because I'm surfing, just because I'm a surfer. It's about me as a person. And I feel like I can spread my light through a lot of different avenues, through conservation. And just like be a light for that type of world and bring awareness for it. Because I think it really all starts with like environmental education, like what you're doing with National Geographic. You're educating a ton of people about something, whatever it do be, like about something people really need to know to change their mindset. One step at a time.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think there's something very sacred about this image, you know, where maybe it's getting to the heart of what I was trying to figure out, which is, okay, you're showing yourself. You're basically being vulnerable. You're like, hey, look, I'm being vulnerable. And I feel like when people see somebody standing up and like, ah, la, la, they're like, if somebody's yelling at you to change your mindset, then you get immediately on the defensive. But if you start from a place of open-heartedness and a vulnerability, then the person on the other end of that message might have to dismantle their own guards. And so maybe in a way, you know, by showing your greatest vulnerability, you're actually creating a gateway into a broader understanding.
Oh, I really love that. I've never thought about that. That's a really neat way to look at things, for sure. And I think through environmental education, people are put back because some of them are like, oh yeah, like riots and this and that. And it's like, that's not the message that I want. I don't want to be like up in someone's face about it. It's kind of showing the beauty of nature, showing the beauty of these animals, and like getting people to really understand like their actions are really making a difference.
Yeah, well, yours are. I mean, you definitely, you know, I like the word inspiring. I think, why not, right? Like, it made a big difference in my life to see people that inspired me to get out of the hospital, but also to have mentors that made me see the world in a better way, that made me see nature in a different way. I've had people that, like, I've got good friends that have been doing conservation work, you know, at the risk of their own lives. And it is inspiring, because we need to be inspired, you know, like the world's imagined. It's created in our perceptions. So we got to inspire ourselves to believe in better things. And I see, you know, I mean, that's you, you're doing it. You know, Liv, this has been a pretty incredible conversation that needs to be followed up in the ocean, obviously. Let's call Kelly. Let's see if Kelly will let us into that surf ranch again. Do you think
we can drive up, knock on the door, be like, hello. We're looking for another barrel, please.
I think there's like a whole, there's a whole group of people that must just sit there on the outside waiting for that, waiting for that door to open, you know? It's so weird. You drive up in the middle of the night, right? Because the night before, and it's got all the, like the spotlights, like a baseball field. And the image I get in my head when I saw that for the first time, remember that? Did you ever watch the movie Field of Dreams? way back. I've just dated myself. Yeah, it's an old movie. It's a very old movie. It's very old. Kevin Costner, probably nobody, you know, is like, remember, you know, he's still around. But it was this movie where, you know, it's there's this line that says, if you build it, they will come. And it's and he builds this baseball field in the middle of nowhere, and you know, these ghosts come and play baseball. I felt like that. I felt like one of those ghosts showing up into the middle of nowhere to ride the perfect barrel.
It's kind of like a Twilight Zone that you're in. Like, you're like, is this real? Like, am I really surfing the best wave ever? It's like perfect. And you, like, everyone there is like so nice. So like, everyone's stoked to get in the water. It's like this whole experience. It was definitely probably the best day of my life.
Yeah. Sure. Maybe the closing thought for this conversation would be, at least on my end, and you'd say your part, whatever you feel. But
yeah,
the biggest takeaway I got from that one day was that what surfers call the stoke. The stoke is infinite, and it is contagious, you know, like everybody's vibe.
Definitely.
And I think that's what you bring to the world is stoke. I can feel it.
Oh, thank you so much. I just want to spread positivity and joy, because I think there needs to be more of it in this world where there's a lot of craziness going on. And I want to be a light as much as I can, even though I'm not perfect, but I try. And I really thank you so much, Albert, for having me on.